April 21st, 2013, in Aventurk, Germany. So we're going to be reading from... Are you going to sit over there?
No, I just played the danga and then...
Had the kirtan. I just finished the kirtan.
Oh, okay.
So we're just going to start with the class.
Okay, yeah. Good.
If that's right.
You're
going to do it, the Deutsch over there instead of having him sit over here to translate. Are you sure? So you're going to do Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 15, the Yoga of the Supreme Person. Text 15. Sarvasya chamriti sannivishto matas matirganam apo anam cha vedas cha sarvaram eva vedyo vedam cha kripveda vedeva chaham. I am seated in everyone's heart, and for me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of Vedanta, and I am the knower of the Vedas. We okay there with the book?
Yes.
Managed somehow or other. So here in this purport, we're going to find an answer to a very often asked question, and I think a question that probably disturbs and bewilders even people who are very religious, even people who are very spiritual, even people who've perhaps even people who dedicated their lives fully to the Spirit. So we're not going to read the whole purport, it's a long purport. We're going to simply read from the bottom of the first paragraph where it says, so we're just going to about the middle bottom of the first paragraph. The Supreme Lord is so full that for the deliverance of the conditioned soul, he is a supplier and digester of foodstuff, the witness of his activity, and the giver of knowledge in the form of Vedas and as the Supreme Personality of Godhead Sri Krishna, the teacher of the Bhagavad Gita. He is worshipful by the conditioned soul. Thus God is all good. God is all merciful. Sarvasya chamri sannivisto matasma jiryan nabopan abjam vedasya sarvara ahaneva vedyo vedanta kut vedyo. So this purport is referring back to some of the previous verses. So we'll look at that also. We'll go back. Here to text 12, where Krishna says, the splendor of the sun, which dissipates the darkness of this whole world, comes from me, and the splendor of the moon and the splendor of fire are also from me. I enter into each planet, and by my energy they stay in orbit. I become the moon, and thereby supply the juice of life to all vegetables. I am the fire of digestion in the bodies of all living entities, and I join with the air of life, outgoing and incoming, to digest the four kinds of foodstuff. And then today's, I am seated in everyone's heart, and for me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas, I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of Vedanta, and I am the knower of the Vedas. So one may ask, is God all good and all merciful? This is the main complaint of the atheists. And why do they say that God is not all good and all merciful? I'm asking you.
So many bad things.
And they happen to us. Has anybody here had a life with nothing bad happen so far in their life? Has that anybody? No. And can we say for the rest of our life, unless we only live another minute or two, that nothing bad will happen? Is that possible? And people that we care about,
Do bad things happen to our mother and father, our children, our brothers and sisters? And many times, bad things happen to people who, from all logic, are innocent. We can accept that something bad happens to the guilty. If you want to do peace, then you really should be up here doing peace. If I have to pause, then you might as well have everybody hear the German.
Just.
Oh, I thought you were going to translate. Yeah, I don't mind pausing, but if I'm going to do that, if I have to pause after every sentence, then better everybody can hear the German also. Thank you very much. So we have no problem with bad things happening to people who we see have done something evil. We have no problem with that at all. We don't have a problem with murderers and thieves going to jail and getting punished, yes? But we have a problem with innocent people getting punished. And so what we generally see in the world is that people who, by our calculation, are innocent, still they have bad things happen to them. In fact, when bad things happen to us, we generally consider that we are also innocent. Isn't that a fact? It's very rare that we can see, what did I do? That's the question that we all ask when we're suffering. What did I do? What did I do? I don't see that I did anything. I am innocent. Right? I just did this. I only did that. And yet, this thing happened to me. I had a very interesting conversation not too long ago with one family. The man had worked for many years for one company. And then, of course, I was only hearing his story. I wasn't hearing anybody else's story. So I don't know if his story is accurate or not. But he said that without him doing anything wrong, due to some politics in the company, he lost his job. And not only lost his job, but he was in a foreign country. And the business arranged that he would be deported from the country and not be able to come back. So when he applied for a visa to return to the country, the government refused him. And he said to me, I don't understand why this has happened to me when I have never intentionally done any harm to anyone else. So in hearing that, I said, my dear sir, I'm very astonished because it seems to me very difficult to believe that anyone has never intentionally done any harm to anyone else. I mean, if we really honestly examine our lives, we would have to admit that there were some times that we caused pain to someone else knowingly, intentionally. Maybe we did it for some higher purpose or for some reason, but still we engaged in some behavior or some words that we were very well aware was going to cause harm to someone else. Is that a fact? Yes? I mean, if we're honest, can we say in my life I have never knowingly harmed another living being? Is it possible? So I was astonished that he would make such a statement. And I didn't directly accuse him, because I knew that wouldn't be very fruitful. But I simply said, I don't know of anybody like that. I said, perhaps you are the first person I've met who can say, I have never knowingly harmed anybody else. So this is our general mood. I'm innocent. I'm like a little newborn lamb. You know, a little newborn white lamb. I've never done anything seriously wrong. If I've done anything wrong, it was some sort of mistake or without my knowledge, and therefore, why am I suffering? And if somebody understands that there must be a God, you've got two classes. One class that says, because I and others suffer unjustly, apparently unjustly, there must not be a God. In fact, this is the only logical argument for atheism. Logically, and one just like in this room, there's these carvings along the walls. They're very simple carvings. They're not very complex. And yet we can understand that they were created by somebody with intelligence. They were created by a human. They weren't created by a chimpanzee or a dog. And they were created by a developed human. They probably were not created by a little baby, like that little baby who left the room a little while ago, would not have had the ability to do these carvings, even though, as I say, they're fairly simple. They're not very complex. Or even this cushion here on the floor, which is, again, extremely simple. We understand that it was created by a human. It wasn't created by an animal. It wasn't even created by a human child. It was created by a human with some developed intelligence. So we're able to recognize the existence of prior design and intelligence in creation. And therefore, when we look at the world, it's reasonable to assume that there was an intelligent, capable creator. Again, these paintings of these lotus flowers around the room, they're very stylized. They don't even really look like a real lotus. And yet, again, we would say that they must be the product of intelligence and purposeful design. What do you speak of a real lotus that has fragrance? These paintings have no fragrance. What to speak of a lotus that has fragrance and soft texture and can reproduce and create another lotus? So obviously that must require intelligence. We have so many just logical, reasonable arguments. You know, when the archaeologists dig in the ground for an old civilization, they have to be able to decide with what they find. Is this just some random process of nature, or is it the result of human beings? Yes? Like if they find a little rock, they have to decide, is this a rock arrowhead that was made by humans, or is this just simply a piece of rock that was formed by random processes of wind and rain? And we humans are very capable, generally speaking, we're very capable of deciding what we see and what we encounter, whether or not it's a product of intelligence. So what we see in the world, all of the different forms of life, certainly fit the criteria of that which is created by an intelligent being. So how are there logical, reasonable atheists? How is that possible? It's like coming into the room and saying there was no artist. Why? Because they see this so-called unjust suffering. They see difficulty which appears to be unjust. So that is the atheist. But even the theist, even those who say that there is a God, there must be a God, there must be an intelligent creator, they still struggle with this concept. Is God really all good and all merciful? When they read this in Srila Prabhupada's purports, therefore God is all good, God is all merciful, they may have some doubt. Well, I'm not really sure. He doesn't seem to be all good or all merciful to me. So is God really merciful? Right. Just simply, of course, if you just simply say that the fact that there's suffering in the world is evidence that there's no creator, that's rather childish. That's rather childish. Just because the design in the temple room isn't to my liking or cannot be understood by me doesn't mean there was no designer. So we'd have to say that's not very logical. But in what way is God all good and all merciful? So here, Srila Prabhupada is speaking on both the material and the spiritual level. So first, on the material level, what did Krishna say he is? Anybody remember? That we read through in the verses.
I remember remembrance.
Remembrance. So, you know that feeling when you try to remember something and you get it? That's Krishna. Okay, what else is Krishna that he said in this chapter? Yes.
Forgetfulness.
He's also forgetfulness. That's sometimes also very wonderful. There's many things that I am very happy to forget, that I want to forget, that I'm grateful to be able to forget. Have you noticed that we all forget physical pain? Isn't that interesting? We can remember that we were in pain, but we cannot remember the pain. We cannot bring back the feeling of the pain. So that forgetfulness is given by Krishna. That forgetfulness is Krishna. And what else does he say that we read last? We read a few verses back. What else did he say? The sun and the moon. So according to the Bhagavatam, the sun does not shine in all parts of the universe. There are planets where there's no sunshine. And there's living entities there that have to exist without the sun. And we can think of how grateful we are for the sun. Just like here the last couple days, it's been very gray. We haven't seen much sunlight. And how happy everyone feels when the sun comes out. Or in a country like China, it's so polluted. If you see a photograph of the cities in China, you'll see that the pollution is hanging very low over the buildings. And it's hanging so low, it's like this dense stuff that you cannot even see that there is a sky. It's hard to explain, but if you look up a photograph of Beijing or Shanghai, so they don't see the sky, they don't see the sun, they can't tell what color the sky is, they can't tell if there's clouds or not, they never see the stars. So how wonderful it is that we have the sun. Even if it's polluted or even if it's cloudy, still we are able to see and to go about our business. Or the moon, how beautiful the moon is in the sky, how after a hard day's work that one likes to come and see the moon, which, as Krishna says, also gives the juice of life to vegetables. So farmers know that if they plant their crops at different stages of the moon, that the crops will grow better and have different flavors. And what else did Krishna say here? Yes.
Intelligence.
So all of us have some intelligence, maybe not as much as we'd like. But whatever intelligence we have to understand things, that is Krishna. What else did Krishna say? Yes.
Perception,
yes. And what else? What Prabhupada was talking about in this purport also, which is why I read the previous verses. Yes.
Krishna is the fire of digestion.
The fire of digestion. So the digestive process is basically that of chemical burning. We're burning our food. And by burning the food, we release the energy to work and to think and to function, and we restore the material of our body. So that chemical fire of digestion, Krishna says he is that. And of course, if we're healthy, we may just not even notice that. But as soon as you're a little sick and you can't digest much anymore, then immediately you appreciate what it is to have proper digestion. And Krishna says he also joins with the air of life. So this air we are breathing, that is also Krishna. And that air, just like all combustion processes, require oxygen. So the oxygen of our breathing allows our body to digest its foodstuff for the whole body and at each cellular level, and to release energy. So here's Krishna's kindness on a material level. If we think about the whole philosophy given in the Bhagavad Gita, that we are a soul, na jayate mriyate va kadachit nayam bhutva bhavitabhana bhuyaha ajo nitya sasvatoyam purano nanyate hanyamaneshaya, we are spiritual beings. And we have taken on this body, dehi nosmin yata dehe komaram yovanam jara tatade antaram praptir tiras tatranamuyate. We've taken on this body, as Krishna explains earlier in this chapter, in the 13th chapter, due to our various desires to enjoy this world. And as Krishna says in the 7th chapter, icha dvesha, that due to our anger and illusion and envy and hatred of the spiritual, we have taken on a material body. In one, a very real sense, we are the criminals of the universe. Those of us who are in this world, we are those who decided, I don't want to be in the light, I don't want to be in the truth, I don't want to be in harmony with God, I want to be in rebellion with God. I want to have my own plans to enjoy. And these various bodies that we get are the particular ways in which we decided we want to enjoy separate from Krishna. These bodies are the gross form of our material desires. So God is very merciful in that he allows rebellious souls to fulfill their material desires. The verse is nicho nicho nam chaitanya chaitanam eko bhavanam yo viryati kamman. That the one eternal amongst all the eternals is fulfilling the desires of all the other eternals. So there are religious philosophies in the world that say that if you don't accept God, if you're rebellious to God, then you simply suffer eternally in some lake of fire or some other hellish punishments. But that is not the instruction given in the Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. But rather, rebellious souls get opportunities to fulfill their desires, even though those desires are in rebellion to Krishna, even though those desires are desires of falsity and desires of illusion. Something like a government knows that intoxication is harmful, but still they have some facility for intoxicants to be available for those who want them. So they restrict them. They may only be sold in certain shops. They may only be sold to people at certain times of the day or certain days of the week. They may only be sold to people in certain quantities with a high tax. Perhaps you have to be a certain age. Perhaps you can only take the intoxicants in certain places and so forth. So there's all kinds of restrictions because they know that intoxicants are bad. However, the government still facilitates people to take these intoxicants. Isn't that a fact? Yes? So Krishna is also like that. When we want to be in illusion, so Krishna tells us, don't be in illusion. That's not a very good idea. You should be in reality. But Krishna is all merciful in the sense that he allows us, if we persist, if we insist, if we say, I want to be in illusion, he allows us to fulfill our desires in illusion. Of course, when you want something that's bad for you, there will be consequences. So our suffering in illusion, actually we are not suffering. The body and mind are suffering, and by identification with the body and mind, we believe we are suffering. Something like if you are watching a film, and the people in the film are suffering, you also feel some suffering, yes? If the person in the film gets something good, you feel happy, and if the person in the film has some suffering, you also have some reaction, even physically. But actually, you're not undergoing any suffering. There's a fire in the film, and you're shaking and you're sweating, although you're not in the fire. So our suffering in this life is like that. It's something happening to the body and the mind. It's not something happening to us. It's an illusion. Our pleasures are an illusion. Our suffering is an illusion. But Krishna allows us out of his mercy that if we want to do something that is impossible, if we want to try to play God, if we want to try to be the enjoyer, if we want to try to enjoy separately from God, if we want to see ourselves as separate from God and separate from other living beings, he gives us this world of illusion. And in this world, he becomes the sunlight and the moonlight and the fire of digestion and our intelligence and our memory and forgetfulness to facilitate what we want. He doesn't simply punish us eternally, nor does he just simply leave us in some state of suspended animation. He allows us to exist, and he allows us to try to fulfill these desires. So that is actually mercy. And we cannot blame God if we want something foolish against his advice, against the advice of all of the scriptures of the world, against the advice of the Lord in the heart, against reality. If I decide instead of drinking water from a cup that I want to try to eat the cup, that is not the fault of the cup designer. Or if I decide instead of trying to walk through the door that I want to walk through the wall, the consequence of my decision is not the fault of the architect or the builder of the building. You cannot say the builder of the building or the architect of the building designed walls to give people pain. That would not be accurate. However, if I choose to try to get out of this room by walking through the wall, I will experience pain. Of course, you can say, well, that's the nature of a wall. Yes, but that is also my own misuse, my ignorance of what is the purpose of a wall and what is the purpose of a door, and my own misuse of things, my using things differently than they are intended to be used. We could say this is the definition of maya, that which is not, seeing things opposite or differently than what they actually are. But that is a willful, conscious decision on my part. So God is all good and God is all merciful, and that He gives us the freedom. He gives us the freedom to make foolish decisions. And He gives us the freedom to enjoy or suffer the consequences of our decision. And if one says, well, I would like for God not to give me the freedom to make foolish decisions, one really has to think carefully. Would you really like that? Just like every day, at least for me, I make at least one foolish decision every day. Am I the only one who does this? Or do other people have this problem? And some of the foolish decisions I make, I know they're foolish when I make them. Again, am I the only one with this situation? Or do some of you also do this? So I know what's good, I know what's bad, I know what's good for me, I know what's bad for me. And yet I still choose wrongly sometimes. Thankfully, not all the time, but sometimes. It would probably be unusual for me to have an entire day go by when I only do absolutely, totally, what I know is best for me. We have this situation? Am I the only one? Is this just my problem? No. All right. So suppose some friend of mine said, okay, I will stay with you all day, and I will have a gun in my hand. And anytime you want to choose something that is wrong, I will threaten you with the gun, and I will make you do the right thing. Or I'll have a gun next to one of your children's heads, and anytime you want to do something wrong, then I'll shoot your child. Would you like that? Would anybody like this arrangement? No? No. So we don't want to be forced to do the right thing, isn't it? We want to do the right thing, but we want to do the right thing out of our own volition, out of our own free will. We might want help. We don't mind getting some help and some support, but we don't want to be forced. I don't want somebody to take my hand and force it to do the right thing. I want to choose to do the right thing. So truly it is God's mercy and God's kindness that He allows us to do the wrong thing. Even though what we really are asking is, Krishna, please let me walk into the wall without banging my head. That's really what we're asking. When we're saying, I want my freedom, I value my freedom, but I don't want to suffer when I make foolish choices. But this is not possible. That's saying, Krishna, I want the result of truth when I do something false. But it doesn't make any sense. Do you all understand how it doesn't make any sense? There is something that's true. What's true is that I'm a soul and I'm part of God and everything is meant to be used in loving service. That's truth. And that's a very nice truth, yes? If we say, I would like exploitation, and I would like selfishness, and I would like cruelty and foolishness to be also true, are we sure? Would we really like that to be the truth? So if I choose selfishness and exploitation, which are false things, then I will suffer. Of course, most of us don't really admit that what we are doing is things that are selfish and exploitive. As I said with that one gentleman, we usually look at ourselves and say, no, no, I am a very good person. I am a kind and giving person. I am a selfless person. I am a loving person. I'm sorry to say that the real story is a little different. And one of the results of chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, maybe I shouldn't tell you this. If someone had told me this, I don't know if I would have started. So I'm taking a risk here. But one of the results of chanting the Hare Krishna mantra and reading the Bhagavad Gita and engaging in this process is we will see ourselves as we are. The veil of illusion and falsity will be removed. Cheto darpana marjanami. the mirror will be cleaned, and one will see the truth. And the truth is simultaneously very wonderful and very sad. The wonderful truth is that we are part of God, we're a divine being, we're full of all good qualities, we're never really materially contaminated at all. We are really perfect beings, invulnerable, glorious, full of most of the qualities of God Himself. And the other part of the truth is that such a great and powerful and glorious being is doing something very foolish, which of course makes it much worse. If an animal does something foolish, who cares? But if a genius does something foolish, if a genius does something criminal, that is a great shame, isn't it? Right? The more qualified a person is, the sadder it is when they do something foolish. So both of those truths become revealed as one engages in this process. And then we see how merciful God is, how God is all good and all merciful to give us facility to fulfill our desires. And that the suffering that we are experiencing, first of all, it's not really us that's suffering. And second of all, it is the natural result of doing something that is false. So God is all good and God is all merciful in that He facilitates the material desires of all living beings. But He's also all good and all merciful in a much more wonderful way. And that is that He is always trying to help foolish, rebellious souls to come back to truth. Now, we might not do this if we had a good friend who envied us, who turned away from us, who cheated us, who denied us. We might not try to win them back. People in my life who cheated me, lied to me, denied me, blasphemed me, stolen from me, I generally want to be as far away from them as I possibly can get. Sometimes I might even wish them harm. So we see that God doesn't wish us harm. But not only does He not wish us harm, but He wants to become close to us again. He wants us to return to our original position. I mean, sometimes when we really had a break in a relationship with someone, and a friend would say, "Would you like to restore the relationship?" We say, "No, forget it." But Krishna never says that. Eternally, He says, "I would like to restore the relationship. I would like to bring you back to who you are." No matter what we've done, no matter what we've said, no matter how we've strayed from the path, it doesn't matter to Krishna at all. We see this a little bit in the relationship between parents and children in this world. Although in this world we don't see it absolutely. So in this world we see between a parent and a child that if the child becomes even very degraded and very fallen, that the parent always hopes the child will come back to the original position and reestablish the relationship. Of course, it's not always. Some parents do reject their children. But a little bit of that idea, that Krishna always wants us to come back. So just like on the material level, we are totally responsible, completely, for our material suffering and enjoyment. On the spiritual level also, Krishna's mercy is always there. It is always there. And it is there equally. So in the Bhagavatam, the demons criticize God. "Your mercy is unequal. You give more mercy to the devotees, to the demigods, than you do to the demons." That's their excuse for being a demon. Like the atheist's excuse for being an atheist is that they're suffering. But that's not the reality. The reality is that Krishna has equal mercy for every single living being. So why is it that some souls are enlightened and some are not? Why is it that some souls come to a state of enlightenment and spiritual awareness very quickly and easily, and for others it's a great struggle? Does this mean that God is giving more mercy to some than others? No. The mercy is there equally. So what is the difference? The difference is our own desire. And Krishna explains very nicely from earlier in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita that the whole purpose of some process of spirituality, so in our ISKCON movement, our Hare Krishna movement, we're teaching a particular process of spirituality. We're teaching a process of bhakti yoga that was given by Krishna in the incarnation of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, particularly for this Kali age. It's a particular process. There are other processes of bhakti that are given somewhat differently in different ages. We read the process of bhakti, say, that Narada gave to Dhruva. And there are other processes of enlightenment also, Gyan Yoga, Karma Yoga, Dhyan Yoga, etc. So we're teaching a particular process. But what is the purpose of this process? So Krishna explains this in the 12th chapter. What is the purpose of, in text 9, the purpose of this abhyas yoga? Abhyas means practice. It literally means it's to repeat. We're repeating something over and over again. We're repeating this mantra over and over again. Over and over again, we're worshiping the form of the Lord. Over and over again, we're bowing down in the temple room. Over and over again, we're offering our food and then eating the prasadam. Over and over again, we're interacting nicely with the other practitioners of bhakti. What is the purpose of all this? Krishna says the purpose is icha. The purpose is desire. Krishna is responding to our desires. So just like on the material level, I have a particular body, a particular birth, a particular life, because I have particular material desires. So how fast we advance in bhakti, what we achieve upon perfection in bhakti, how easily we advance, is dependent completely on our desires. When we fully and completely and only desire to be in truth, then we will be. That is by the mercy of Krishna. We cannot achieve truth by ourselves. Daivi esha gunamayi mama maya dirajaya mam evaye papajante mayam etam durantite. This energy of illusion, it's very difficult. Dirajaya. But if we actually desire to be out, we will be out. Something like you may have gone on a ride in an amusement park. You understand what that is? They have these rides like roller coasters or Ferris wheels. So when you go on one of these rides, you have to want to go on the ride. It's not that someone just goes to your house and kidnaps you and puts you on the ride, huh? You have to want to. You have to buy a ticket. You have to pay some money. But you cannot go on the ride on your own. You have the desire, you pay the ticket, you pay the money, you get the ticket. But somebody has to put you on the ride, yes? And then they put a bar in front of you so you don't fall out, so you don't actually get hurt. You experience some fear, but you don't actually get hurt. And then someone has to start the ride. You can't start it yourself. And then when you want to get off, somebody has to let you off. You cannot get off by yourself. But you get off because you want to get off. So it's exactly like that. We cannot be in illusion by our own strength, nor can we get out of illusion by our own strength. But Krishna is responding to our desires. And just like on the amusement park ride, you're not really suffering. So in this world, we're also not really suffering. Actually, the soul cannot be damaged. So when we want to get off completely, then immediately. Therefore, Prabhupada said, Krishna consciousness can be the matter of a moment only. And why is it not that way? That we have to say, that generally we do not really want truth. Generally, we do not really want truth. Think about some good friends of yours where you can see their problems, but they don't want to see them. You all have this experience? Some family member or some friend, they come to you with a problem. I am having this problem. and you look at the situation, you can instantly understand why they're having the problem. Instantly, immediately, you can understand. But if you try to tell them, they don't want to hear it. Have everybody had this experience? And they don't see it at all. You'll say, well, you're having this problem because you're doing this. I'm not doing that. Why do you say I'm doing that? Yes? And it's very interesting that we all notice this in others, and I've come to the conclusion that if others do this, I probably do this too. We tend to think everybody else is like that, but I am not. I've concluded that must not be the case. And I have learned with my friends and family members, there are certain things I just don't talk about at all, because I know they won't listen. And every once in a while I may try, and then again it doesn't work. So I also assume that other people are like this with me, that there are many things that I really should hear, and I really should change, and I really should fix, but the people around me don't say anything, because they figure she's not going to listen. So this is Krishna's situation with all of us. Here he's saying he's in the heart. Sarvashichaham Ridisham Yavisto. Krishna's in the heart. And he's giving us knowledge and intelligence. But he's giving us knowledge and intelligence according to our receptivity. And Krishna is very, very smart. And if there's something we're not going to be willing to hear, he's not going to tell us. If we want to see truth, then we have to be willing to see the truth. And there are some parts of truth that conditioned souls are not particularly anxious to see. Part of that is how foolish I am to be a conditioned soul. Part of it is how great and glorious God is. A lot greater and more glorious than I am. I am very small and very insignificant. Therefore, we say that the doorway to real spirituality is humility. Humility. The eager willingness, the eagerness, the enthusiasm to know the truth, to accept the truth when we know it, and to act on the truth when we accept it. If we are consistently genuinely willing to know truth, to accept truth, and to act on truth, then we will experience that Krishna's mercy is there, just like the flowing water on this property. It's flowing without stopping, quickly and beautifully in our heart. And our progress will be very, 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 very rapid. So seeing that Krishna's mercy is there is not the matter of some kind of trick. It's not that some people have more of a fortune than others. But to meditate on how Krishna's mercy is already there in our lives, and to be willing, on a very deep level, to accept that mercy, to see Him, and to see the truth. And that is available to anyone. It doesn't matter how old you are, what country you're from, what your gender is, how smart you are, how healthy you are, how much money you have in the bank, how beautiful you are, or anything like that. The only thing it's dependent on is one's genuine, real desire to know and act in the truth. So we have 5 minutes if anyone has any questions or comments. Yes.
Thank you very much for all of your lecture. I'm thinking this actually power of desire is something which is pulling us in this material world, but
yes,
it's the same thing which is also able to pull us out of this.
Yes.
So I was thinking, is actually possible how to increase this desire? Is this coming from us, or is this mercy?
The mercy is already there. It's just like in this room there's electricity. It's already there. So how to increase one's desire? So that is our whole process of bhakti. That is the purpose. Everything that Srila Prabhupada has given us, everything that Lord Chaitanya has given us through Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, has that as its intention. According to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12, text 9. Every single thing that we're doing, that is the intention. That is the purpose. To increase our desire to the point that that desire is so strong and so overwhelming and there's no other desire. And we, that's fine. That's fine. That may be me 40 years from now, so that's fine. No problem. So not that I want Krishna and. I want Krishna under these conditions. I want Krishna if there's no price. I want, when it gets to the point that I want the truth and I want Krishna no matter what is the price, and I don't want anything else. And that should not be misunderstood in some sort of fanatic way. You know, when people first take up spiritual life, they often go through this fanatic stage, which is not real or deep. It should not be understood like that. So how to increase that? Whatever you do, realize that that's what you're doing it for. Focus on that. Why am I chanting? I'm chanting to increase my desire. Why am I taking prasadam? Why am I reading the books? Why, whatever you're doing. Have that as your goal. That's what I'm trying to do. Everything we're doing. Everything. Krishna says he's the light of the sun. Why just chanting? When you see the sun, how wonderful Krishna is. How much I appreciate the beauty and the warmth and the light of the sun. Just imagine if I could be with the source of all light. How beautiful the moon is. If I could be with the source of all beauty. When we're digesting, so we're just about to go have our feast, yes? And digest. So to be conscious. How amazing Krishna is that he's designed the machine of this body. There's no medical doctor who understands all the workings of the body. Incredible. Do any of us have any idea how it's actually working? It's just working. Yeah? Wouldn't you like to meet that person? So you meditate like that. When you're digesting, oh, I'd like to meet this person. Who's the fire of my digestion. I'd like to meet this person who's alive. I'd like to serve this person. I was recently visiting a family. The wife was always cooking, and always cooking large quantities. And at some point, right before I left, I looked at her and I thought, I really would like to do something for this person. I'd like to make this person happy. I'd like to serve this person. We feel like this sometimes, yes? Around somebody, I wish I could do something to make this person happy. I just meditated on her good qualities and then I wanted to serve her. So, that anybody can do, but one has to do it intentionally. Of course, if you go through the process of bhakti just mechanically and externally, eventually it may awaken that desire, but it might take a very long time. Anything else? Yes. Oh, I have a whole seminar just on this topic. A whole 1 hour seminar. So I'm going to give you a 30-second answer. So if you want a very highly placed job, you probably have to take an exam. If you just want to sweep the street, there's no exam. If you want to be a pharmacist, there's exams. There's tests. Yes.
Isn't the time of death and belief for our body a good opportunity to realize the truth about ourselves?
It would be very good if we realized the truth about ourselves before that.
Before.
Yeah. And actually, also to answer your question about tests, all of our tests are due to our own nonsense. Because if we weren't conditioned souls, there wouldn't be any tests at all. We stay in our natural enlightened position. There's no need of test. So whether you want to say, is this due to my karma, is this due to Krishna, ultimately it's all due to my nonsense, even if Krishna is arranging the test. But tests are a very good opportunity to show that we really do desire the right thing. The whole idea, the concept of sannyas, sannyas is renunciation, is to die before death. What is the real problem of death? Why don't we like death? And Krishna says it's just like changing your clothes. So why don't we like death? It's like sometimes we don't like to throw away our clothes. Huh? You picked out this piece of clothing, you picked out this whatever. You know. You got these shoes, you really like the shoes. Maybe you spent a month or two researching what shoes to buy. Maybe they're very expensive shoes. Maybe you spent 100 euros for the shoes. And you really like them, you really like the color, you really like the way they fit. And then they get old, you have to throw them, it's with regret. Oh, now I've got to get a new pair of shoes. So death is like that. Death is, we've invested a lot in this particular identity. Our identity in this life is false. We are not the person that we appear to be in this life. We are not this particular body, and we're not this particular personality either. So in this life, you may be very quiet, or you may be very outgoing. You may be very organized, or you may be very random and artistic. You may like challenges, or you may like things to be the same every day. So we have different personalities in this life. We have a different appearance. We have different knowledge and skills and talents that we've amassed with great trouble. We have all these relationships that we've spent so much time and effort and energy on developing. And death means start over. All of that's gone. We used to do a little drama called The Wrong Bank Account. So this man, every week after work, and when he got paid, he put money into the bank. And when he went to retire, he went to get out his savings. And the man at the bank said, "There's nothing in your account." He said, "But all my life I've been putting my money in the bank." He said, "But you're putting it into someone else's account." So we're putting so much energy into my relationships on the material platform, getting our material knowledge, our material identity. And at death, you find that's it's all gone. Then you start with another body and another identity, and you build that up again. So what we are trying to do is we are trying to develop our real identity now, in this life. Who am I really? And invest in that. And that is like death. And we no longer identify with the false identity. That doesn't mean we're useless in the world. Actually, we become more useful in the world because we realize that all our relationships and our things belong to Krishna, and my real identity is Krishna's servant, so I will actually take much better care of my relationships and my things than I did in my false identity. But if one dies now, if we relinquish our false identity now, while we're so-called living in this body, actually we're always living, we never die, then what will death be? Nothing. There will be nothing. Actually, there's nothing. Just walking from one room to another. But if you don't relinquish the false identity, don't count on death doing it for you. You'll simply get another false identity. Now, don't think automatically at death, I'll gain enlightenment. That's not true. If you don't voluntarily relinquish material attachments at death, you'll simply get a new set of material attachments. Yes?
Actually, I mean, it's a time you have time for working on it.
Maybe. Depends how you die. maybe. You might die instantly in an accident.
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe you get some warning. Maybe not. But anyway, we all have warning. Everybody, I am now giving you a warning. This body will die. So warning is there. Guaranteed. So warning is there, and we have time to work on it. Yes. There you go. So that's there for all of us, whether we're 20 or whether we're 80. Maybe the 20-year-old will die sooner than the 80-year-old, especially nowadays, one never knows. But better we sarva pati vinirmuktam, better we give up our false identity now. So thank you very much. God is all good. God is all merciful. All right.